Forward.
Okay, we've done it.
Perfect.
I can hear you well, very well now.
Me too, same here.
Okay, perfect. So let's just start.
Have we been on speaking to the world here for a while?
I think they put us off for a while, but now I think we might be live. Are we? I will ask them. But let's just start. Okay. Okay, we are back. Okay, so hello everyone, and sorry for the little delay. We had some technical audio issues that we needed to fix, but now we are all set and can start. Okay, so again, good evening, Dan. Okay, for you it's the morning, I think, but morning. In Europe it's evening. So.
Right. Beautiful day here. Stuck in our houses in isolation.
Yes, but how are you doing with the isolation?
Very well. With my wife, we just realized that it was the 55th anniversary this week of our first date. So, really? which was the Students for Democratic Society March Against the War, against the Vietnam War, which I was working on the war in the Pentagon, but she induced me to come join her for the march since she said that's where she would be. So I left the Pentagon and marched around the White House protesting the war and agreeing with most of what I heard, actually, amazingly enough, like most people in the Pentagon. But the president said, carry on, so we did.
Okay, and okay, now that you started that topic, it's a wonderful story. So somehow through falling in love with your wife, it changed maybe the course of you becoming a whistleblower later?
Yes, yes. We broke up actually over the war in Vietnam. I was there for 2 years. And I got the feeling from her that she didn't appreciate what I was doing to try to damp down the violence in Vietnam. And she just said, how can you be part of this? And my part, I thought, was to moderate the violence in what I already saw was a hopeless struggle as far as the U.S. is concerned. So I actually broke off our engagement at that point, and we were apart for 3 years. We've been engaged. And when we got together again 3 years later, 1969, I had already started copying the Pentagon Papers and expected to go to prison for life when they came out.
Wow, that is such a chilling story all in all. And I'm really happy.
But it turned out well, as far as we
know. Yeah, that's what I wanted to say. I'm really happy that you had the luck to not be incarcerated for the rest of your life. Or even
absolutely. What? I was up for the first year of our marriage, which was in 1970, August 8th, 1970, was spent really putting out the Pentagon Papers, essentially. I was trying to get them, still trying to get them to the Senate, which I'd tried in 1969 already, before we even got together. They didn't do it because they were afraid they would suffer political penalties. If they did, then I gave them to the New York Times. But we really spent that first year, she was crucially helping at that point, helping copy the papers, so I would have enough copies that the FBI would not be able to swoop down and get all of my copies, so I had them secreted here and there. And then for the next 2 years, I was on trial facing a possible 115 years in prison, 12 felony counts. That was something like a record at that time in terms of sentences, although Julian Assange now faces a longer possible sentence, 175 years. Strictly speaking, it would come to about the same thing. So life imprisonment. So until 1973, that was our marriage. But then on, it so happens now that I think of it, on August 8th, 1973, the anniversary, our third anniversary, Nixon announced his resignation.
Oh my God.
That was not really foreseeable. And that crucially happened, would not have happened without his fear that I had other documents that would reveal his nuclear threats against North Vietnam, which he had made. Mm-hmm. And he had to stop me from putting those out. So he took criminal actions, or actions that were then criminal, of sending CIA assets under the White House, that is people, into my former psychoanalyst office to get information to blackmail me with, into silence. And then there wasn't any such information. He later sent them, much of the same people, to incapacitate me totally, mm-hmm. which the prosecutor understood to mean kill, on the steps of the Capitol on May 3rd, coming up on an anniversary there, 1972. And with a number of crimes like that, there were others as well, all intended to keep me from demonstrating with documents what I was saying, that he was making threats of escalation in Vietnam and including the possibility of nuclear weapons, which most people don't understand or don't know to this day. They never really believed my threats because I didn't have the documents that he feared I had, but I should have. I knew well people who had seen folders, target folders for nuclear weapons on North Vietnam in 1969, in his first year in office, the same month that I was copying the Pentagon Papers. And Roger Morris, for example, who resigned over the invasion of Cambodia from the White House, resigned from the White House with four others, told me later that it was the greatest shame of his life and regret that he had not brought out the documents that Nixon feared I had. So he didn't give them to me or give them to the papers. As he said later, we should have thrown open the safes and screamed bloody murder, because that's exactly what it was. He said, that's exactly what it was. And that didn't get carried out, the plans for nuclear attack, for only one reason, that on October 15th, 1969, and he had threatened these attacks for November 3rd. And the targets that Roger had seen were scheduled for November 3rd, one of them only a mile and a half from the Chinese border, and others on the borders of Laos and others for the Ho Chi Minh Trail. Instead of threatening that, Nixon faced 2 million people in the streets on a weekday, actually not a Saturday or a Sunday, not a holiday, but 2 million people all over the country, because they scheduled this walkout, which was actually a general strike. And they feared to call it a general strike. It sounded too radical for America, even though there had been general strikes way back in our history. And they said, okay, the only way to deal with this is a general strike. We'll have one day first on October, 2 days on November 15th, next month, 3 days on December. And when I say general strike, people leaving work, leaving school, congregating in public squares, demonstrating against the war, or lobbying in Congress and others, as I say, during the day, shutting the country down, essentially. Well, it didn't shut the country down, but 2 million people, because 100 here, 500 there, 10,000 some big cities, even a couple of, at least one where there was like 100,000 people. And that was either New York, I think, or somewhere else, or Los Angeles. Anyway, it added up all on one day, and he could not carry out a threat to escalate, his threat to escalate the war. He couldn't give the speech that had been drafted for him by Roger Morris and others, explaining that today, pursuant to my orders, those were the first words, and they joked about it later, today, pursuant to my orders, bombers are flying, and actually, bombers with nuclear weapons aboard were on alert at that time in the air and in civilian airfields, and he couldn't do it because of that demonstration. And the next month, indeed, there was an even larger demonstration in Washington itself and so forth. So those people, including me and my children in Los Angeles, had no idea they were preventing nuclear war. And they were. Actually, they were keeping that going till today. So they were having an immense effect that they couldn't have foreseen. I personally was copying the Pentagon Papers, not because I thought there was any chance of an escalation in Nixon's first year, but that down the line, within a couple of years, there would be an offensive, as there was in 1972, which would cause Nixon to use nuclear weapons. And indeed, in 72, he was discussing nuclear weapons with Henry Kissinger, his national security assistant, while I was on trial. I had put out more documents by that time on trial. But he was saying, I want to do something dramatic, Henry. You know, how many did we kill in Laos? And Henry says, I think 15,000 or something. He says, no. He says, close the ports. And how many would die if we bombed the dikes? And Kissinger says, 500,000. He says, no, no, no. This is the way he said it. No, no, no. I'd rather use a nuclear weapon. Got that, Henry? And Kissinger, to the credit he's gotten later, says again very calmly, oh, I think that would be just too much. German accent. And Nixon then says excitedly, too much, Henry? You think that would be too much? I just want you to think big, for Christ's sakes.
Oh, my God. And
that's right. So they didn't do it then, but days later, he's saying to Henry, Henry, the only thing that you and I disagree on, the only thing you and I disagree on, is you're so damn worried about civilian casualties, and I don't give a damn. I don't give a damn. And Kissinger says, I just don't want you to get the reputation of being a butcher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a Nazi butcher, and so forth. So that was actually the week when, fearing that I would put out documents which I didn't have, but could have had if Roger Morris had given them to me.
So he thought that you might have the documents.
He was not paranoid if Roger Morris had given me the documents and so forth, but they didn't do that. So
you basically exposed the presidents before him. So you exposed the presidents for or what before Nixon?
This is Nixon. This is Nixon, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah. No, I'm just referring to the material that you revealed.
Yes.
Referring to the other.
Yes, right. What I did reveal with the Pentagon Papers was material. The Pentagon Papers were a history, a 47 volume history, every page top secret sensitive, of our decision making in Vietnam from 45 to 68. They ended, in other words, before Nixon came into office, so they didn't directly threaten Nixon. But what they did show was four presidents before him, and really Eisenhower, Truman, Kennedy, and Johnson had all lied about their aims, what they were planning to do, what the consequences were likely to be, totally misled the public at every stage of the way, and this ended in 68. And of course, what I did know, but I didn't have the documents to prove it, what I did know was that a fifth president, Nixon, was also lying, also making secret threats, and he intended to carry them out if he didn't get his way, which he never did. He was making demands that the Vietnamese never did accept. So I expected the war to get larger, and in an attempt to do what I could to shorten that or prevent that, I was putting out this history in hopes that people would see that a fifth president was doing what four previous ones had done. And I failed at that. People simply could not believe that, having been elected to end the war, as he promised, honorably, that he would expand the war. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't believe it, and they didn't believe it when I put it out. It was only when the word came out unexpectedly of the crimes he'd taken mainly against me, that domestic crimes against an American citizen, that actually led to his impeachment hearings and led him to resign on our third anniversary.
And this saved your life, so to say.
Well, it saved my life. Of course, it saved me from prison, but which I was expecting. But much more importantly, it made the war endable. Mm. I'd understood from 69 on that the war would not end with Nixon in office. My main source on that, Morton Halpern, who was still working under Kissinger, said this war will not end, the war will not end with Nixon in office. And in 72, after the revelations of Watergate, of the break into the Watergate hotel, he won a landslide election, landslide. So that was November 72, the largest bombing in human history took place in the week after Christmas that year, after the election. Kissinger had been on television first time that the president, the public was allowed to hear the German accent of the key advisor to the president. And he was allowed, they had banned speech recording accompanying his picture. And he got on for the first time to say before the election, peace is at hand, peace is at hand. Followed by, after the election, the largest bombing in 2 weeks in human history. So at that point, this was now a year and a half after I'd released the Pentagon Papers. When people asked me what effect the papers had had, I had to say, truthfully, no effect, no effect. We're here, the war is on, the war heaviest bombing of the year after I did this, not only those 2 weeks, but the whole year before that. Mm-hmm. And the whole peace movement has had no effect. Well, but I was wrong. I was wrong, but that's what I thought then. Yeah. And yeah, go ahead.
No, I just wanted to say, but in the long term, it did have a big effect.
No, I'm saying I was...
Subsequently, what happened to you through him assuming that you might have the papers and doing all criminal activities, so it led to an end through a different way. But now speaking of presidents lying, I was just thinking of, you know, at that time, it seems to me that at least people were shocked when they find out that presidents lie to them.
Absolutely. And,
but it seems from today's perspective so weird, because we have a president that is lying every day. I mean,
world. the world has an American president who lies several times a day. If it were just once a day, it would be about 1/6 of the lies that he does, because Trump has been clocked at an average of about 6 blatant lies a day. And it's added up to, I think, something like 13,000 by this time. So you're absolutely right. The political environment has changed. It is true that when Johnson, before Nixon, had been found to have been lying repeatedly, he couldn't run for office, really. That wasn't the only factor. He'd kept a war going. That was the main factor. But he shocked people by the lying. Nixon is keeping the war going and could not have won without another factor, which let me come back to, because it refers to today very much. But it is true that he was shocked, they were shocked by the lying. And that has totally changed, because the people who back Nick Trump, at least, absolutely pay no attention to his lying. But I'll tell you another factor then that was true then and now. The reason that Nixon was able to win, and very few Americans have connected all these dots, you know, but I've been so obsessed with these issues over history that I really have kept up with news as it comes out, as it gets leaked. And I say, how does that change what we knew earlier, or what I thought earlier? How was I wrong earlier? I didn't know this. And here is a major factor. There's one American in 1,000 who would tell you the 1972 election was won by Nixon on race, on racism. And that was, I don't know what American would tell you that, but here's the fact. After conducting the war for nearly 4 years, Nixon was not doing well in the polls, especially when he was faced by George Wallace as an independent voter who had run in 68, and now he ran as a Democrat first in the primaries in 72, and then was about to run as a Democrat, as an independent. Mm-hmm. He had, first of all, let me say, the base for George Wallace in 68 and 72 were Southern racists, mainly, and Northern racists, and blue-collar ethnics, Catholics and whatnot, who felt displaced in some cases by busing and by efforts toward civil rights. They were the George Wallace base. They included, by the way, Michigan, or in the North. Had Wallace run as he was determined to do in 72, Richard Nixon would have lost. He not only wouldn't have won, he wouldn't have won narrowly, he would have lost. Wallace could not be on his feet and have Nixon win. When George Wallace was shot on May 8th, 1972, And, you know, this is, I'm on trial on the first part of my trial, election year. All the Wallace vote went from Wallace to Nixon. And that gave him a landslide. And those, he had been working for 3 years to be number two in the hearts of Wallace voters by promising law and order, which was a code name for keeping blacks in their place, basically. But that wouldn't do him any good if Wallace was running. But when Wallace was shot, immediately Nixon had a landslide coming, no matter what Democrat went against him. And that's what happened. So that the Trump base right now, the 32 to 38% of the people who will back him, whatever he does in the way of lying or anything else, basically, is the Wallace base of support. It's either the same voters, or, you know, that's a long time ago, it's their sons and the people in the same jobs. And the people who are, what Hillary Clinton very fatally for her effort called deplorables. And that was not fair. These people are very ordinary, very normal, patriotic Americans, very decent in many ways, except that like the Confederates in the South that led to the Civil War, many of them are racist and sexist, very strongly sexist against Hillary for Clinton for that reason, very chauvinistic nationally, against immigrants that they feel are taking their jobs, against Jews that they think are pushing civil rights down their throats. And they were demonstrating in Charlottesville a couple of years ago now, saying Jews will not replace us, a very strange cry. What was this? People didn't understand it. This is the one, remember, where Trump said there are very good people on both sides, and it had to do whether or not there should still be a statue of Robert E. Lee, who led the Confederate armies in support of slavery. And Trump was saying very good people on both sides, but those people were giving Nazi salutes in many cases, something I haven't seen in my lifetime until now. I hadn't seen that in public. And it happened on the night of Trump's inauguration, neo-Nazis saying, Heil Trump. Okay, that would be almost forbidden in Germany, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it is forbidden in Germany. And yeah, what you describe is, of course, something that is obvious on the one hand, but it's also shocking to see that it is nearly like a cult in a way. And you said it's at least 30%, maybe also 40, that he has this cult following. It's like a cult because it doesn't matter what he does. I mean, he's contradicting himself on a daily basis. He's openly lying, but it doesn't seem to matter what he does. I think it's more about what he is, because I think you would maybe agree that those people maybe think he's just one of them because he talks like them, he walks like them, you know, and they feel that they can openly be racist again because the president himself is doing it. So, you know, this is what, the whole PC debate and so on in America, I think that it got somehow erased by Trump, or at least he gave allowance to people to be again. It's okay to be racist. It's okay to be sexist, and so on. And it's very frightening to think of it when you think of the numbers of people that are like that. You know, literally the white men, not necessarily the white old men, but I think there is a lot of white young men also involved in that. So I don't know. It's very cynical, you know. And so.
Cynical? Why do you say cynical?
The cynicism of these people in somehow seems so high in a way that they just don't care about anything that is ethical or him being a liar or I don't know. It's very hard to grasp. I don't know.
Well, let me give you a slightly different view. No, I, as you know, I think, you know, I couldn't say better what you just said. I agree with it entirely. When you say cynical as though there's no morality involved, I think there is a morality. It's a different morality. It's a different ethics from what, let's say, you and I are committed to. were Confederates in our country, the people who fought for slavery, were they without morals, without ethics? Did they have no conscience, no guilt, no nothing? No, I don't think that's the case. They felt to their bones, they had been brought up this way, that part of their identity, their moral identity, was white Christian culture. And that was patriarchal in particular. And that for women must be kept in their place, which was subordinate, and blacks must be kept in their place, which was subordinate. And other people, like whether Mexicans, to where the Confederates aspired to bring slavery to Mexico. By the way, not very Americans know what I've learned relatively late in life here recently, that the Texas declared independence from Mexico largely to enable slavery in Texas. Mexico had abolished slavery, and the Confederates actually wanted to reintroduce slavery and to invade as much of Mexico as possible. And of course, they took away a very large part of Mexican land. They didn't succeed in making it all slave territory, but they wanted to. That was their desire. And that's a large part of what the Civil War was fought about, not the existence of slavery, but the expansion of slavery, which the slavers had in mind. And that's what brought the war. Well, I believe that a large part of this country, I'm sorry to say, this is something I've learned now, in a way, since Charlottesville, when I began to think, ask, what's going on here? I didn't foresee this as a significant movement in this country. I thought that was all in our past somehow, as a lot of people did. Well, I was wrong. And I began looking at much more history and whatnot, what had been before, going as back as far as the Revolution, which was led, after all, by slave owners. Our most revered icons, the first presidents, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, all slave owners, as had been 9 of the first 11 presidents in our country. I didn't know that when I was, until really quite recently.
I didn't
recently.
Know either. It's something that is never really mentioned or addressed. I'm surprised.
So the slavery of the Civil War is ended, but in effect, the social and economic aspects are reinstituted, maybe 10 or about 10 years later, 1876, more or less, the end of Reconstruction, and a century of Jim Crow ensues, where the blacks are not literally enslaved, but it's like apartheid. They definitely have a low second class citizenship, especially in the South, but not only in the South. So, in other words, I've learned about my country in a way that's not reassuring, but it explains to me what's going on. As you said, people who voted Democratic, like myself, and the racists had left the Democrats now with Wallace's shooting. They went to the Republicans. Now, to say that, for instance, is that the party that I thought of myself as belonging to most of my life, the Democrats, I had not faced up to the fact that the racists were in the Democratic Party. The Democrats had what, when I was growing up, was called the Solid South, that was sure to vote Democratic. Because, this is an issue, by the way, that's been raised even under Biden. I saw it just today. He may change this. Even under Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, in concession to the South, Social Security and various kinds of workers' benefits were not extended to agricultural labor, which was in the South, essentially black, domestic labor, largely black. That's something that we may correct today. As Biden, I noticed in a column today, I just said, is actually proposing to extend those benefits more than they have before. But then the very heavily racist part of the country switched over to the Republicans, who were no longer just the party of the rich. And when I say racist, sexism is a very strong part of that, and includes, by the way, a startling number of women, white women, who think that their gender is generally fine, maybe even better than men, but not for president. And Hillary lost the votes of a majority of white women. That's an astonishing discovery, but that's what happened. in 2016. So sexism in some degrees is as strongly rooted or even overpowers racism, because after all, these same people had voted for Obama when he defeated Hillary in the primaries back in 2008. So we have a problem here. Now, it's not only in America. The problem of it, well, you know, very obviously in other countries now, the chauvinism against Muslims in particular, who now come into Europe in a big way, much more than here, as workers, and as migrants. Mm-hmm. Now, let me move for a moment here to the major threats that we're facing as a species. We're seeing one now, a hint of one. It's a really a warning. The pandemic is that we're facing right now is just a warning of pandemics in the future. At the worst that's expected now, we can expect, some have said, the century of pandemics because of the urbanization that's gone along throughout the world, in part related to globalization and, you know, extension of production all over. So people crowded in major cities make pandemics almost inevitable, and it's easy for a pandemic strain to be more lethal and more infectious than CV19.
Absolutely, and you know, so and I'm also thinking what will happen when all the ice is melting, you know?
Well, now you have the climate.
Because when all those, because there are, I think there might be also viruses, bacteria, and all kinds of diseases frozen that existed millions of years ago. And once they get released, you know, when the water starts to rise, you know, I mean, it's really something that came to my mind. I was thinking, wow, we have this COVID virus now, and it maybe came from a bat, from the laboratory or the market, whatever, it doesn't even matter where it came from. But when I imagine what will happen when all these things get released that were in the permafrost for millions of years, what we will face now. So this seems just like a little rehearsal to the things that we will face in the future. And I sound too dystopian now, but for me, this is really a wake-up call, also in terms of climate and everything else. And also, by the way, you also mentioned nuclear weapons and things like that. And I think in a weird way, they totally got forgotten, you know?
I was just reading now a book that just came out here. See if you can see this. My friend Noam Chomsky,
yes.
Called Internationalism or Extinction. Very, very good book, and some I read it in an earlier form, but I was just rereading it today. Extremely good. And of course, he's one of the few people who really links in urgency and passion the problem of nuclear weapons and the problem of climate. Most people look at either one or the other, and that's enough to keep them worried and occupied and committed, but he very clearly sees the two. And then, of course, the book just came out, so it also mentions toward the end the pandemic as a third problem. And it's again, the pandemic, the current pandemic, doesn't remotely indicate the scale of death and disease issued with nuclear war or climate. But future pandemics, yes, a century there, do reach that possible scale. And when you mentioned, by the way, the connection of the pandemic with climate, also another aspect is that drought, as well as rising sea levels, will almost certainly cause enormous migrations.
Yes.
We've seen what's happened politically in Europe. And unfortunately, Angela Merkel, with her letting a million people in from these areas that were hit by drought as well as war or preceding the war, that's 1 million, 2 million. We're talking about tens of millions, hundreds of millions moving from climatic changes that are being brought about by human agency right now, and very specifically by corporations like Exxon and all the other oil giants.
Yes.
Who are increasing with, by the way, the interest, very interestingly, a side effect of the isolation here now.
Is the
We're seeing a world go way down now, yeah. Because, and they're paying people to buy the oil, paying them to buy the oil as of today, first time in history, to store it because they don't have a place to store it. Well, the world demands, society demands, that what Exxon and the others are all pulling up out of the ground should be left in the ground. As a matter of fact, the oil right now that they're putting on boats and everything else should somehow be put back into the earth rather than burned. That raises the question, when we go back to work, when we need energy in the factories, what should it be based on? We have months and maybe, in very tragic ways, years to go before we're back to economic activity on a large scale. What should they be doing? Should they be fracking and extraction of oil in Arctic lands and elsewhere? Absolutely not. What is likely to happen? Well, that we go back to doing it all as before and even before. That's very likely. To say otherwise is simply not realistic. And yet, if you want human society to remain, then realistically, we should not go back to building missiles and warships and maintaining the doomsday machine. And we should not be lifting oil out of the ground where it needs to stay, but building solar panels, building sustainable energy systems altogether. And that means confronting the power, the economic and political power of the strongest institutions outside government in the world. And those institutions have pretty much co-opted the government. They buy the government. So we're going against enormous opposition to try to keep the skies as clear as they're becoming this month. It's very unlikely, but we shouldn't regard it as impossible. Because exactly.
I really love this quote, that it's unlikely but not impossible. I really like that. And you know what? We already speak for 50 minutes, which is, I'm surprised to hear. And we have some questions from the audience come in. But before I come to the questions of the audience, I also want to show your book to the audience and recommend it, like you recommended Tom's book.
I'm very unhappy that there is no German edition or French edition or anything. There's nobody on the continent. They didn't want to pay the expense of translating it. And I have offered, and I'll offer again right now, I would like to see this book translated and give up my royalties entirely to any nuclear efforts that sell this book with no royalty to me for whatever difference that makes. And on at the lowest cost, because I do think it's important for people to understand the danger we're in.
Yes. I just also got the message from DM that we can speak a little longer because we started later due to our technical problems. So should I ask you one of the questions that were sent to me? Okay, how do we find the energy to campaign for the release of individual whistleblowers, considering the terrible things affecting millions of people in the world? Is there much hope that we can move the judicial systems of states to release people?
There is some hope. By the way, the man who, to some extent, was Trump's accomplice, and then once convicted, turned against him to be almost a whistleblower, Michael Cohen, his former attorney, being released from prison now because of the virus, you know, and the dangers in prison. And that should, of course, be enormously magnified, people being released from prison where they're in great danger of contracting this and giving it to other people. Another person not being released is Julian Assange. Julian Assange, with his immunity system compromised terribly by 7 years outside of sunlight, confined in the Ecuadorian embassy, and now in isolation, 23 and a half hours a day, 23, in a prison for terrorists in England. and have strongly urged that he be released and compassionate, you know, on bail or whatnot, because he's in great danger of a death penalty in that prison. He's not being released. And the message is, of course, to whistleblowers, as it was by giving Chelsea Manning a 35-year prison sentence, earlier Bradley Manning, to Assange, by the way, for giving her secrets to Assange, and Ed Snowden in permanent exile now, all this. This is meant to keep, to do what Nixon wanted to do with his crimes against me, even after I was indicted, because it was clear that indictment was not going to shut me up. You know, I was talking as much as I could, and I was free to do that. That wouldn't be true today. See, total isolation for these people. But to keep them, me from talking, committed crimes, well, for the same against me, to shut me up. Again, he's done this to Chelsea Manning, to Assange, to Ed Snowden, you know, in exile and so forth. And the purpose of that is that it takes unusual moral courage, a willingness to give your freedom, be ostracized or anything else, to tell the truth about what the government is doing. Now, what we're seeing in this pandemic is a truth of Baron Oxenstierna, major statesman of Sweden, said to his son, "My son, do you not realize with how little wisdom the world is governed?" And the pandemic is opening the veil on that almost right around. Some countries doing better than others. Germany, I understand, New Zealand, a few others. But I think this may reveal to Americans, as to others in the world, how badly they're governed. And the message of the book that you held up to them, which the Doomsday Machine here, is how badly we've all been governed by nuclear policies, which are extraordinarily dangerous and terrible, like the preparation for climate, except the preparation was essentially no preparation for pandemics, which were easily foreseeable. And the Doomsday Machines in Russia and America, and the somewhat smaller ones in seven other countries, are all designed to bring about nuclear winter. They are preparations for the annihilation of most people on Earth. They should not exist, certainly in that form, even when some nuclear weapons in a given country can be justified to deter nuclear attack by an adversary that's armed with nuclear weapons, the ability to retaliate, whether it would never be sensible to exercise that ability, but to have it can have a deterrent effect. But to have the number of weapons that each of these countries actually have, how about the 300 that China has? In what circumstances would it be safe for them to use 300 weapons, which would have the capability of ending most life on Earth? Well, China says quite reasonably, actually, as things go, we're not ending going into negotiations with Russia and the US, who have 10 times as many weapons as we do, and on alert. And, you know, with their little finger, practically, can a part of that weapon can end life on Earth. So it is, of course, inexcusable for the U.S. to have that. But that has not created, it isn't even an issue in the campaign here. And other countries in the world, every one of which is endangered by the danger of a war between U.S. and Russia, of the kind we each side talks about in terms of first use of nuclear weapons. When the U.S. talks about it, when Putin talks about it, as he has, and exercises first use, initiating nuclear war, which would lead to an all-out war with the U.S. almost certainly, and vice versa, every country in the world will be annihilated by that as side effects, as collateral damage. So why aren't we hearing from them? And the answer is it would get them in bed with the U.S., the richest country in the world they depend on. And that's enough to keep them quiet. So in answer, I'm sorry, I've gotten away from your question, but I'll come right back to it. Yeah. It's essential, I think, for the change that we need in the world, which will not come from the states, and it will not come from the multinational corporations. Mm-hmm. It will have to come from people below, from grassroots, who have to learn more than they know yet about the dangers that are facing them from the policies of their governments. And that will require people to reveal the truth from inside. We do need more whistleblowers. Just the governments feel so strongly we need fewer, and that's why they're taking such measures. But we need to penetrate the secrecy. Julian Assange's initial idea of unveiling both corporations and governments, and by the way, some of his earliest revelations, I recall, were from China, and I wish WikiLeaks would be opening up China considerably, but which is closing down the internet, or rather controlling it, rather. But in the major countries, of all of them, Germany, which has continued the surveillance that was initiated after the Second World War by the U.S. and passed it on to the German Secret Service here, the surveillance all over the world that threatens democracy, which is, again, another aspect under threat, just like the climate, like the nuclear, no one makes this point. There's a movement now of what you could almost call a fascist international. Let's say Noam Chomsky calls it an ultra-nationalist reactionary cabal or axis or coalition somehow, which we see, you know, in so many parts of the world, in Brazil, in Hungary. And I believe our president, Donald Trump, aspires to be like those he most admires in the world, a president for life. And in other words, I think he is an actual danger to democracy. And that's one more reason why he must, in the interest of the world, be replaced. And that will not go easily. I'm not at all convinced that he will give way to an election result against him simply without emergency moves to suspend the elections, to ignore them, say that they were false and whatnot, to use military means, as Nixon was feared to be prepared to do rather than leave office on August 8, 1973, 74. His defense secretary, James Schlesinger, had to give orders that were essentially unconstitutional. Because the president had a constitutional right to give any orders he wants, basically, to the military. And Schlesinger was so worried that Nixon would not allow himself to be put out of office that he gave orders as his Secretary of Defense to the Joint Chiefs of Staff that they must not obey orders from the White House without checking with him, without going through him. That was little known at the time, but it's a fact. I believe that measures like that will probably be necessary in the next 9 months, but not only here, as we see the devolution of democracy in Hungary, for example, and in Turkey and other places. That's going to be a widespread problem. And so she was saying, how can we do this? I think in part, we need to change the ethics, which put very much, basically condemn whistleblowing. Mm-hmm. On the grounds that the president knows best, you shouldn't be putting out information he or she doesn't want, and you shouldn't break a promise. And that's one of the most human moral feelings that there's ever been. Don't tell outsiders the secrets of our group, whether it's a small group or a larger group or a huge group. Don't tell outsiders what we may have done wrong or our leaders may have done wrong. Mm-hmm. Don't break your promise to keep that secret. And people who are whistleblowers have universally promised their corporation or their government they will not tell secrets. And they, like including me, break that promise when they realize, in every case that I know, that as humans, they should have, and they find they do have, a loyalty beyond that promise. In America, we've taken an oath to support the Constitution. And when we see the Constitution clearly violated, as this president has done, and as Nixon did, as Johnson did, George W. Bush did, when we see it violated, some people realize that they've taken an oath to oppose that and expose it, even though that will cost them a risk or a probability of life in prison or possibly death.
Yes.
Or possibly death. And the point is, it is worth a life. Of course it's worth your life when you recognize that you were being asked to participate in mass murder or in the destruction of society, as is involved in the climate case. Let me give one very immediate example. We now know that, as in the case of every catastrophe known to me, a human catastrophe, social catastrophe, there were inside warnings of that. That is, that's always denied. Who could have seen this coming? We didn't know. That's why we didn't prepare. Always a lie. I don't know counterexamples. So in this case, of course, the pandemic is classic. We now know that there were the highest level urgent warnings of this pandemic from late January on, and to some extent from earlier than that, but very urgently from late January, 2 months before the president actually acted against it. He was overriding, as happened in Vietnam, as happened in Iraq, in many cases. He was, and by the way, in the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, there were urgent warnings that this would lead to the disaster that it did for the next 10 years before they got out. And the warnings are overruled. The leader takes a gamble, a risk of other human lives. And that's very human. When humans get an authority, that's what they do rather than lose office. Okay, what we need inside and out, because it has to start out at mother's knee and at everybody else, there are loyalties that are more important and that should override loyalty even to your family, which is the highest loyalty many people acknowledge, loyalties to your president, to your ethnic group, to your nation. Yes, these are important. These are not to be, and they certainly determine your status in society, your career, your freedom, and so forth, if you ignore those or if you violate them.
There is
a loyalty higher. If we can develop a loyalty to the human species and a loyalty to all life on Earth, actually, that overrides these loyalties, that's what the pandemic is showing right now. Mm-hmm. And that's what the climate crisis should be showing and acted on. And that's in the crisis of democracy, where it exists, is shown to them. We've got to develop a concern for all people on Earth, which most humans really don't have, and I'm not accepting myself on this, and they don't act on it. That would be something new for the species. We might be the first species to have a species concern for the rest of our species, and yet no other species has ever had the capability to destroy itself by its own actions, and along with it, every other large species that would go with nuclear winter or in pretty much with these climate change, except for the places that are newly habitable, let's say. But with the nuclear winter, 99% of humans would go. If there's a war between the US and Russia involving nuclear weapons, it would almost surely escalate. It would not only be 99% of humans, probably not 100, but 100% of nearly every other large species. When the asteroid hit the Earth 66 million years ago that killed the dinosaurs, it didn't just kill the dinosaurs. It killed everything down to about the size of a squirrel or a marmot. And that's what we evolved from eventually, 66 million years later, 200,000 years ago. We evolved from those small animals. And now, with our intelligence and our technology and our language and our ability to collaborate, we have the dark side of those abilities is that we have produced in being, in operation, the ability to wipe out that human society, human civilization, most other species, and are constantly, day by day, though less so this month, for the first time, are building our economy on knowingly, people knowingly inside, except for the deniers who are like people. There are some people who still belong to the flat earth society. Yes. And there's probably a large number of people, larger, who believes that the sun goes around the earth, as after all, you can see with your own eyes every day. They still believe that against science. By the way, a larger number, I'll bet, than you you could imagine. We can look it up on the web. Whenever you guess the number of people are that are going the flat earth or the earth around the sun, sun around the earth, I'll bet the number is larger. We can just look that up.
I'm afraid it is, so yeah.
But we have a party in power, in the U.S., the Republican Party, that is built top to bottom and climate change deniers led by the president. That's why Noam Chomsky calls it the most dangerous organization in the history of humanity, devoted to putting as much fossil fuel, burning as much fossil fuel as possible, finding new areas of it, fracking, getting more of it out of the ground, and denying the effects of that. And in this case, they're joined by the Democrats, maintaining a doomsday machine. Mm-hmm. And in the case, that's not only the Republicans who have built preparations for overthrowing democracy. There was a big leak on that just a couple of weeks ago by William Arkin in the Washington Post, showing the preparations now that have long been in existed, but are now being put into practice to some extent to essentially work, change our form of government, basically suspend the Constitution, move the seat of government out of Washington. That might be necessary in the virus, and could be in some cases, but with that excuse, basically suspend democracy, pretty much. Yeah. So all of these are facing us, and humans are capable of changing that, as they did, going back, if I may, to our very first words here, as did happen in 1969 with what was called the moratorium, the general strike. Mm-hmm. And a terrible irony in my eyes is we are going to be facing decisions in months or years that deserve a general strike. Mm-hmm. But you can't have one. We're on a general strike, in effect, right now.
We are.
You can't have major demonstrations. What is it called? Against extinction in Britain is good.
Extinction rebellion.
They couldn't really responsibly do what they've been doing in the way of gatherings and civil disobedience, or the kind of joint civil disobedience that my wife and I do every August 9th or 6th, Hiroshima Day or Nagasaki Day, which gets in the way of our anniversary every year, against nuclear weapons. Well, we get together, we get arrested, there's 100 people or so. Can that happen this year? We can't get together. We'll see what's happening in August.
But, to see from the bright side, I mean, like you said, so many things are now impossible, like we knew it, but maybe we should never let a good crisis go to waste. So I still have hope that, like you said, there it's so weird because we cannot do a general demonstration or strike, but on the other hand, we are forced to do a strike in a way because it's just coming upon us. And for me, I mean, many things are really horrible about this. Also, the fact, like what you just mentioned about the leak that just happened and was obviously exposed by the Washington Post that you mentioned before about the fossil fuels and stuff, but it didn't even occur to me to read it because everything is so overwhelmed by this pandemic. And this is also when I think of Julian Assange that you mentioned before being in prison. His extradition hearing was to be continued in May, beginning of May. And I'm actually signed up from a newspaper in Germany for the Freitag. I already reported about it for them. And I was supposed to go to London to witness it, but I don't know if it will even happen. So we don't know because everything is on standby in a way. And his case, it's really bad because he's in danger, like you said, and so on. So many things are really kind of pushed aside by this, and people also use it, you know, to just get their way. On the other hand, I think that vice versa, there are also new possibilities and ways that, yeah, like you said, it's unlikely but not impossible that, yeah, I have the feeling because we have done so much looking back into history and learning from it. But what we also learn is that many things repeat themselves all the time. And somehow I've, at the moment, at least, maybe that sounds stupid, I feel the need to kind of think things newly, you know, to absolutely think, okay, because this what now happens, it was so unexpected to me, although there were warnings about pandemia, but it was not thinkable, you know, especially not something on a global scale, and to, in a way, also to stop capitalism from doing what it's doing, you know. In, like if, when you would have proposed people to stop flying, you know, because of climate change, everybody said, oh, no, it's not possible. We have to fly. And all of a sudden, you know, you can, you know, a few days ago, I saw the first time a really clear blue sky without the trails and in Berlin. And you can see that it has such a strong effect. So maybe I'm just delusional optimist, but I'm somehow hoping for a better outcome. And also something that you just said, which is really touching, is the human concern that we might start to think of each other and on a more larger scale than we usually do. So okay, but now I got carried away by this. I will just, can I because we are already 15 minutes over our time, but I want to, can I pose you one or two more questions from the audience? Because we get like 20 questions, so we cannot do all of them. So
I'm in no rush. I'm in no rush. No problem.
Okay.
I'm here.
I just also got the news.
I have nowhere to go.
Okay. Yeah, same here. So, okay. So let's take our time. Okay. Let me see. I will just choose one, which is maybe... Here is someone coming back to what you said about the voters of Trump, you know, so-called deplorables. Yeah, by the way, I find it very interesting that they started on Twitter when Hillary, back in the last election, when she used that term, many of these people who are Trump voters used the term deplorables in front of their Twitter name, which was really weird. So they just kind of, they did something which was usually done by punk, which I found somehow chilling, that they adopted the, you know, to take something which is actually negative and put it proudly like an accolade. So anyway.
By the way, if I may say, I didn't make something clear that I meant to say.
But, let me ask a question. Maybe you
okay,
can...
Okay, go ahead.
You mentioned, what are the different morals or ethics that Trump lovers are committed to?
Yes. I think that their age-old ethical frameworks and moral frameworks, let's say for Christians, that very frequently refer to Romans 13, I believe, in the same chapter says, obey your rulers. They are given by God. Obey your rulers. You know, the divine right of kings. Kings for a very long time, and kings are really development to some degree of nations after the Middle Ages. But the idea that they were divinely authorized and needed to be obeyed, even by the barons, even by the local lords, that's very, very strong still. The idea of authority that must not be obeyed or society will fall apart. In the same chapter, I believe, of Romans, is women obey your husbands. And the idea of patriarchy, the idea that the father, the man, the male, is a king in his own household, over the women and over the children. This is ethics. Very, very, very strong. And the idea, in other words, many people react against the idea of a woman president, very simply. European countries and others have gotten quite used to this. And even, but I live in a country that has never had a female president yet. And I think that's a very, frankly, there were some females like Elizabeth Warren that I was very strongly favoring. I would say that I was favoring either Bernie Sanders, for whom I voted in the primary, or Elizabeth Warren. But I think very much counting against Warren was the fact that she was a woman. Now, that's a moral feeling, you know, that women are meant to obey, basically, and to follow. And then Christians in the South, evangelicals, definitely point to slavery as compatible with the Bible, which it is. You know, over and over again in the Bible, it's never condemned, per se, slavery. And in fact, I was just reminded the other day, which almost was mind-boggling, but in the Ten Commandments, actually, in Exodus and elsewhere in the Bible, the commandment, thou shalt not covet or steal, includes in its slightly larger form in the verse, do not covet your neighbor's slaves. Okay? That's in the Ten Commandments. Not criticizing slavery, and by the way, not criticizing war or genocide. I'm talking now about not only Christianity, but the Torah, the Old Testament, what we call it. It so happens I was raised on both the Old and New Testament in Christian Science. It so happens. So my father studied at least an hour a day of both Old and New Testament. I'm very familiar with from his lectures to his family.
Yeah, I was just thinking that you are quite knowledgeable of the Bible.
Think of this. If you look at Exodus or Joshua and some of the other early books, you find God commanding genocide in order to clear the area, first of heretics and idol worshippers, but also of people who to make room for the Israelites, for the Hebrews. So here you have God again and again commanding, kill every man, woman, and child, and animal. And when they keep some of the women as a booty or animals, God reproves them and says, you have violated my commandment. That's calling for what we later called unjust war. It's calling for the Hebrews to do what the U.S. did to Germany and Japan, actually, and what the Nazis did in the Blitz of London, indiscriminate bombing from the air of man, woman, child, and animal. And that was an adoption of Nazi ethics, in effect, which were aimed at winning, as well as exterminating Slavs and Jews, and Roma and Gypsies and so forth. But they didn't regard, Hitler didn't regard London, that he admired the British Empire. He had no desire to kill Britons per se, but in order to win, and he failed over Britain, he sends his bombers to burn London to the ground. And that was an ethic that we adopted, and Churchill adopted, and FDR adopted. And Franklin Roosevelt, who was a very admirable president in many ways, nevertheless presided over the largest act of terror in human history. And that was not Hiroshima or Nagasaki, which were done under Truman, his successor. That was the firebombing of Tokyo that killed between 80,000 and 120,000 humans in one night. And that was Franklin Roosevelt with the approval of Churchill. Coming right back to the human condition, what I wanted to explain earlier was when I said that Hillary was, in my opinion, not only politically mistaken, but actually was mistaken to call these people deplorables as people. What is deplorable were attitudes that they shared, that it was wrong to participate in raising women to be beyond their, you know, have more power than they should have, or to allow blacks to be equal. It was wrong to say that blacks were as good and as dignified, as, you know, as worthy of respect, as important as white people. That was an ethic. And it's, so I would say, a deplorable ethic. And it wasn't invented by Americans. It goes back to humans in general, I think. The idea of us against them, we against they, with we and us being superior, morally superior, every way superior, in one way, not perhaps in every way, not in wealth, perhaps not in power, but in worthiness and importance and morality. That's very deeply human. And if we continue with that, armed with us having and they having the power to destroy the environment and the climate and the nuclear weapons above all, those very human attitudes are making likely the destruction of our species, or certainly our society, our civilization, and many others. So we have to learn a new ethic, is what I'm saying, that really has the idea that there are human loyalties that go beyond loyalty to your national leaders and your ethnic, national and ethnic group. There are loyalties to human. That's not a common universal, that's not even a very common human idea. And the state denies it, said that is wrong. You should not act that way. You should feel guilty, you should be ashamed, and you should be punished if you act that way. And that's on the basis of that, that Chelsea Manning and Ed Snowden were punished or exiled, indicted them. Mm-hmm. Actually, there were many people who approved of much of what Chelsea did in the way of revealing crimes mm-hmm. by the U.S. Of torture and assassination and others. But they criticized her for revealing things that the U.S. didn't have much to do with. Mm-hmm. And they actually failed to notice that Chelsea very openly said, I think that injustice and oppression in the way that the first world, not only America, treats the third, the former colonial world, needs to be exposed. She was acting on a loyalty that went beyond being an American, although as far as I know, she was a very patriotic American at the time. And Snowden, exactly the same. Mm-hmm. They said, yes, it's many people here said, it's good that Snowden revealed the surveillance of us that was unconstitutional and criminal. That was good. But he also revealed surveillance all around the world. That wasn't his business. If the U.S. wanted that secret so we could get at everybody else's secrets, why should he reveal that? And his attitude was, by the way, I'll tell you, it's in Germany. He said, I don't think it was wrong to be surveilling Merkel as an intelligence thing. That's a targeted surveillance on an individual by intelligence agency. That's what intelligence agencies
are supposed to do, right?
Are supposed to do and do. And he didn't object to that. Others might, but he didn't. He said, my objection is they'd listen to every German, not just every German, everybody in the world. That's wrong. Is it unconstitutional? No. Is it illegal in America to do that? No. But he felt it was wrong in the way of making democracy virtually impossible or threatened everywhere. Now, Snowden is, as I think you know, and as Sarah Harrison knows, an exceptionally patriotic American.
He is.
He's not only, as am I actually, but we're not only loyal to America, we are concerned about what America does to other people, and even about what other countries do to other people. It's a concern as humans in the world. Mm. I can't say exactly citizens, because citizenship can be taken away by countries, you know, and it doesn't, nobody's accepted as a, there's no overriding authority.
Yeah.
Maybe, but there can be an overriding loyalty. And that's a new ethic, largely. It's not invented by anybody new, by us or anybody. It's been there for a long time. Gandhi talked in this way. Martin Luther King talked in this way precisely. I have a quote right in front of him, amazing, that he said almost exactly what I've been saying here about the need for concern and loyalty. And by the way, King and Gandhi tended to call it love for everyone. And I have never accepted that fully. I think that's when you talk love, you're talking about something that is more personal and more selective, more subjective, more idiosyncratic than I'm talking about, or that is available on a universal basis. but concern and loyalty, as much concern as for our own family, let's say, that's not human in a way. That's not going to happen. But going against what actually existing humanity, is zero concern for most people outside the largest groups that we identify with, nation, religion, ethnic group or whatnot. That excludes most people in the world. And for those, unless our leaders tell us to be concerned about them, or there's a catastrophe like a tsunami, there's occasionally concern for people we otherwise would not even know they exist and would not be concerned. But now that we, our own national policies threaten every human and most large animals in the world, all of them, we have to learn not to be, to see they're unimportant, they have no importance, which is the way corporations deal with them, essentially, and most states. That's wrong. I would say morally wrong, ethically wrong, wicked, but yes. And involves a different ethic from what...
There is also a certain aggression, auto-aggression in it, because I think if you, like you said, only love or have concern, I'm using the word love, in this context, like Gandhi and Martin Luther King, I know what you mean, I understand it. It's, I think sometimes this word can be used because it's so strong, you know, it's yeah. The idea that you might...
I think it's too strong, I think it's unrealistic.
Yeah, very yeah. strong, but on the other hand, maybe that kind of, you know, brings up a certain energy on the one hand, but you are right, it's also concern, but I feel that when you have this concern only for your own religion, for your own nation or and so on, starting with the family, okay, which is kind of a natural given, but all the other, like religion, organized religion, nation, it's something that was invented and it has the potential to be something which is auto-aggression, because I think it is exactly the reason that we are destroying ourselves, you know, by destroying our neighbor or what you say in Christianity, like dein Nächsten in German, you know. So anyway, I'm getting a little bit off of it. But also I wanted to ask you something very simple. You know, when you talked about you and Ed being patriots, and I just, when I visited him the last time in May, he was still an American patriot because he was still very convinced of the American Constitution, which is very fine. Although he's starting to learn Russian now, but if he hears that, hi Ed, and I hope you're doing well in the midst of this madness. But what I wanted to ask you, despite the fact that you both declare yourselves as American patriots, especially in terms of the American Constitution, that you wanted to protect from the criminal doings of the state or the presidents and their power structure, you were considered by many people being traitors. I mean, now today you are considered like a hero, thank God, or thank you, but for what you've done. But how long did it take for people to acknowledge that it was right what you did? And what do you think, how long will it take till Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden will also be considered heroes?
Well, of course, from the very beginning, there were people who were admiring and supportive and appreciative of what I did. And there were also very many others. I've never seen an actual poll that breaks them down, but certainly very many others who thought I was a traitor, which is absolutely against our Constitution, because our Constitution actually defines treason. It's the only felony defined in the Constitution, so it would take an amendment, a constitutional amendment, to broaden it. And that was because, actually, our country was founded by traitors. Every one of them, a loyal subject of King George III in 1773 or 1774, and worthy to be hung in 1776 by George III, and they understood that when Benjamin Franklin famously said, we must all hang together or we will surely all hang separately. That was not just a metaphor. every member or everyone who'd signed the Declaration of Independence was liable to be hung as a traitor by King George III, and several of them were, actually. So they put in the Constitution that treason should be only making war against the United States or adhering to its enemies, giving them aid and comfort. Now, to say that, Chelsea Manning adhered to what, the Taliban? That would be absurd. Or Edward Snowden adhered to some enemy of the United States, absurd. So they aren't charged with treason, actually. They couldn't be, constitutionally, and I wasn't. I had 12 felony counts. Treason was not one of them. But breaking with my promise, breaking with my team, breaking with my party, the Democratic Party, which the Pentagon Papers exposed, that led to the word betrayal very commonly, and treason. Anybody who's breaking with your group, basically, will be seen as a traitor to that group. If the group is doing wrongdoing and you expose it to outsiders, that can be the only way of changing that behavior, actually. And I think I don't know any whistleblowers, and I've sought out and I know a lot of them. I don't know one of them who was interested in punishment for people. They were interested in practices that harmed others being changed, being stopped. And for that, they were willing to risk their freedom or even their lives. So there was an instance then of moral courage. It was Bismarck, I think, from your country, who defined civil courage. It's a German word. And said, which is amounts to moral courage, and it's by civilians, but he said that courage on the battlefield, and he was speaking as a Prussian, is very commonplace. But moral courage, civil courage, called it, is very rare, even among otherwise decent people, reasonable people. And that's the point. I haven't fully expressed the way I meant to. The people who have these attitudes that I deplore and practices that I deplore are not to be dismissed as less human. They're as human as humans have ever been, actually, and like all other humans. Humane is not a synonym for human, although it's always often defined that way. Acting humanely and decently and with kindness and compassion and all that and concern for others is not a universal way of being human. And people who don't act that way, I say, are not less than human. They're very human, but they're acting in ways that are deplorable, attitudes that need change. And that's my morality and that of many others. And as I said to your questioner earlier, I'm not saying the other people are immoral, but they have a different morality, which I deplore, and different beliefs that there is a God who ordained our rulers. No, I don't think so. And when Bush actually said, as a born-again Christian, God told me to invade Iraq. He actually said that more than once. I said he should have gotten a second opinion on that one. If somebody tells you to invade a country that hasn't threatened us or anybody,
it's really
that wasn't God. But there's no God exists that, in my opinion, that does that. Although in the Bible, it happens all the time.
Yeah. Sorry. Okay. Let's. Okay. Now we are. We are at 9:30 now. But I will do a last question, I think. Oh my God, there are so many of them.
Who? You can send some of them to me afterwards if you would.
I'd
like to contemplate them if they're written. That's interesting.
Okay, maybe something.
I can address some answers to you, but on email.
Oh, it's so difficult to find which one I should take. Yeah. Okay. Here's something concerning the outbreak again. China is often accused of covering up the beginning of the viral outbreak. Do you agree? And do you think the U.S. would have been more transparent?
Well, no, that's easy to answer.
Yeah.
After the truth was out and acknowledged by the WHO, the World Health Organization, which was a little tardy on this, and tardy, it said, because they gave more trust in China's early lies and secrecy about this than they should have. China acted exactly the way Trump did when he got the word. What I started to say earlier was many people here first thought China was not telling the truth, and then they started to, and the World Health Organization started to, and they were passing that on to the president, telling him. Not one of them, to my knowledge, told the public or Congress or risked their own jobs by being a whistleblower, even though they saw what was coming as humanly catastrophic. And their only measure to change that was to tell the president, and the president ignored it. He didn't want to believe it or announce it. So that was a challenge to them now, to tell the public, tell Congress, tell the court, tell the world. They didn't do it any more than China did. And what I'm saying is they were acting in a very ordinary, normal way for humans to act in power where their jobs were threatened if they told the truth outside their channels of authority, both in China, where the lower people did that, and in America, and in many other countries. It's the way people act. Now, unless we change that considerably, more than it is now, unless you have more people ready to risk their jobs, we won't survive very long. And that means we probably won't survive. This won't change fast enough. It won't change widely enough. But it is possible that there will be people like the original person in China, Li, who did tell the truth and was punished for it, had to retract it, and died of it later because he went back, like the hero in Ryu in Camus' novel, The Plague. He went back to do his job, and he exposed himself, and he died of it. But he had done what he could to tell the truth. That's something that everybody in every walk of life, we're seeing amazing heroism right now. We are in China, in the U.S., and in virtually every country. Yes. We are seeing people who knowingly risk their lives to keep things going in health, in transportation, in grocery stores. And yes, many of those people are doing it because otherwise they couldn't afford to eat in our system. Yes, and they're doing it for their families and for them. But many of them are not doing that for that reason. They are exposing themselves in hospitals and in transportation and other ways, very clearly acting as heroes, physical heroes and moral heroes. Governor who are defying the president on this issue in order to keep their own people. That's not just to keep their jobs, that's to help other people. So, and they're risking their jobs when they do that. So, We're seeing humanity at its best and its worst. And the worst is quite normal, actually, except that it's terribly dangerous at the moment. So, America not only could have acted like China, it did act like China. I mean, our leaders did act like China, exactly. We've seen it. And up till this day, the president is alternately denying, and agreeing with spreading terrible untruth daily, just like China, just like almost every other country. And there are some, New Zealand and others, who act quite differently. And as I understand, Germany, Merkel is acting differently now.
I think that we are in Germany very lucky because we have a very strong health system. Although it must be said that also this health system used to be better. I think they also abolished a lot of things in the last years, especially in terms of people who work there. We have a lot of equipment. We have enough intensive care space and so on, really lots. They are still not occupied, but we have a problem with manpower. So there are not enough people to do the work, So that is the main problem in Germany. But on the other hand, I'm also positively surprised on one hand, although also they contradicted themselves in the beginning and so on, but they were kind of transparent about it, They admitted, okay, in the beginning we thought that, today we think that, and I'm in a way positively surprised from the German handling of the problem. And yeah, I'm really lucky to be here because the situation isn't as grim as it is in countries in Europe like Spain or Italy, which is really horrible. But so yeah, it's actually okay. Germany is doing okay, but we will see what happens, you know, because we are still in the middle of it. And I'm really wondering how it will go on. And what I also like is we have some really interesting individuals here that are among the scientists, like one virologist. He is kind of the first scientist to found out the SARS virus, like in 2003, I think. His name is Professor Christian Drosten. He works here in Berlin at the Charité. And I will interview him also, I hope, in one of the next shows here. And he is someone who is very transparent. In a weird way, he isn't a whistleblower, but what he did is very much making whistleblowing unnecessary, because he put his papers, his scientific papers about the virus online, accessible to people when he first find out and things like that, which is very unusual. So he kind of didn't follow the academic protocol, and in a way, you know, in order to save lives. So I really admired that. Yeah. So this gives me some hope, you know, that people act in a way that is transparent. Oh, my brother is calling.
Sorry.
I declined. sorry. But okay, maybe this is the signal to stop here. But I just wanted to say, yeah, maybe we end on this positive note also what you said about everyday heroes and people who are doing everything to make us keep up our standard of life, and especially in the hospitals, but also in the grocery stores, or even the people who are still carrying away all the waste. I mean, we will drown in waste if they didn't. And so, maybe this is a nice thought of ending this evening. Although actually, it's horrible to say goodbye. It was so beautiful to see you again then. And it feels like you are around the corner, although it's, my God, it's in San Francisco and I'm sitting in Berlin. So there is a lot of space between us. I hope to see you soon again. Maybe we can continue with our conversation on Zoom. Like,
I'd be happy to. Anytime.
Anytime. Yes. So my hugs to Patricia also. And and thank you for everyone who was listening. So maybe you want to just say the last words to our audience?
Well, I've been thinking as you were speaking, I got a whistleblower award in Germany from the Federation of German Scientists and also from a Federation of German Jurists together. Mm-hmm. And while I was waiting to get the award, it was a biannual whistleblower award. And I asked the Chief Justice, I believe, of the Administrative Supreme Court, what is the German word for whistleblower? I want to acknowledge it. He said, we have no German word for whistleblower. That's why it's a whistleblower award. And so, how good to be in a country that has no need for a word for whistleblower. But I said, what would be the nearest equivalent of that in Germany? So he thought for just a moment, and then he said, Verräter. They translated for me as traitor, as you said, which I am so often called. And I said, yes, is there perhaps, what's the another word, a better word, a different word? Thought for another moment and said, Petzer, which I translate as tattletale in school, you know, a teller of tales, somebody who tells the teacher on his classmates. And I said, well, it's like that in my country too. And when you say that I'm now seeing much more commonly in the last 10 years, I can say, since 2010, as a patriot and a hero and so forth, it's to make me a contrast, totally untruthfully, to Chelsea Manning or to Ed Snowden. They want to say, well, they're bad, but after all, they did what I did. So they have to say, oh, Ellsberg did it differently. Somehow Ellsberg was good and so forth. And of course, half a century has gone by and no harm has ever been attributed to putting out the Pentagon Papers. So, and it is widely understood that it had some role in shortening the Vietnam War, although people don't generally know how that happened. But so when you ask me, when will Manning or Snowden or Assange be seen more favorably? Well, each year that goes by, that, you know, the blood on their hands is not there, you know, as opposed to it didn't happen, whereas so much blood is seen on the hands of the people they exposed. That has some effect. But basically, we want to look forward to a world in which people do as these others did, and I can say as I did, who felt a concern and a loyalty to people outside their own nationality, as well as their own national and ethnic group, and acted on it at a risk. That can save us. That can be the miracle that is needed to preserve civilization. And fortunately, miracles do happen. Gorbachev did happen in Russia. Mandela did come to power in South Africa without a violent revolution, with a minimum of violence. Those were miracles. No one foresaw them. No one foresaw them. It was seen as impossible. And yet the impossible did happen. That's what we need now. Humans are capable of change and learning, and we need it fast. Thank you, Angela.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.